and thunderstorms in a low of 62. Thursday, it's going to be cloudy with a 50% chance of rain and a high of 74. By Thursday night, we should expect a 30% chance of rain. That should clear up by the weekend, by Friday night through Saturday. We're going to see lows in the upper 50s and a pretty small chance of rain. Taking a look at temperatures around the state right now, it's cloudy more or less everywhere at the moment. In DeKalb, partly sunny at 68 degrees. Chicago O'Hare Airport, it's 68 also. In Pontiac right now, it's partly sunny and 70. Mostly sunny in Bloomington and 71 this hour. In Peoria, mostly sunny and 70 at the moment. In Champaign at Willard Airport, it's 72 degrees, and it's 71 at Friends Plaza in Urbana outside of our studios. You're listening to WYLL.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Meadows Edge at Clark Lindsay, a new community to be located adjacent to Meadowbrook Park on the east side of the Clark Lindsay campus. Meadows Edge will offer villa accommodations for active adults looking for condo-style homes. Learn more at clark-lindsay.com.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WYLL. I'm Chris Berube. There's currently proposed legislation for a higher minimum wage at both the state and federal levels, but some of the fastest-growing fields, like home care and restaurant workers, aren't included in the minimum wage. Illinois Public Radio's Shannon Heffernan reports on how labor laws allow workers with disabilities to earn less than everybody else.
When I meet Michael Grice, he's sharply dressed in a turquoise pinstripe shirt and nice beige slacks. He says people are quick to judge him because of his disability, so he pays special attention to his appearance. Grice has cerebral palsy. A few years ago, he moved into supportive housing at Ada S. McKinley. The agency also provided him with a job doing piecework.
I'm filling bubblegum machine, packaging boxes for different companies.
The agency is allowed to pay workers with disabilities less than the minimum wage. That's because they have a special license under the 1938 Fair Labor Act. Ada S. McKinley says it allows them to give people jobs who otherwise couldn't get them. Each worker's wage is calculated based on their individual ability. For Grice, it was less than a dollar an hour, a big drop from the wages he earned before when he was working at a bank or university gym.
To buy the essential things was impossible. Clothes, hygiene products, to get a haircut, it was just impossible.
His concern about looking good was compromised. He also said he didn't feel like he was making a real contribution. Sometimes he didn't even cash his checks.
I was embarrassed to cash a check that was $5.40 for 2 weeks. I didn't even bother. It was, believe me, very degrading.
Grice said he couldn't afford to go to the movies or out to dinner, so he was rarely out in public. He felt isolated. Grice's wages aren't that abnormal for workers with disabilities. According to the National Core Indicators, the majority of people with these jobs earned less than $2.50 an hour. Still, the license agencies say they are doing important work. Envision Unlimited serves people with developmental and intellectual disabilities. Susan Gardner is Division Director of Day and Employment Services. We tour one of their centers in Logan Square.
All right, well, let's start over here.
There's a big open room with bright painted walls. In one section, people are playing card games. There's also a section with low light and quiet music for relaxation. In another area, people paint.
Scott, what are you doing? What are you doing right now?
Cave.
Towards the back are big industrial looms and a cutting table. This is where people with hourly jobs make tablecloths and napkins.
And for napkins, I have to put it on the 18 and a half.
People move freely between work and recreation. Gardner says they learn a range of skills here, like socializing.
Right. See where it says napkins?
I do see that.
Most of the agencies that pay subminimum wages are nonprofits. But many get contracts from for-profit businesses to do piecework. Gardner says all the money they bring in from the contracts goes directly to materials or workers' wages.
If we weren't allowed to pay subminimum wage, we would price ourselves out of the market. And then those people would not be able to earn a check. And you can see they were invested in what they're doing. They were taking a lot of pride in what they were doing. And it's preparing them to take those same skills into the community and really be a functioning part of the community and the work world out there.
Envision says that about 60 people they employ now have regular jobs, including two women who have worked at Shedd Aquarium for over 30 years. But work placement rates like Envision's are rare. 95% of people with these subminimum wage jobs never go on to get regular work. Illinois is particularly weak. It ranks 44th in terms of placing people with these disabilities in regular jobs. Advocates are especially critical of larger organizations, like Goodwill, where executive directors earn huge salaries and have multi-million dollar budgets, while workers make so little. Renee Luna is an advocate from Access Living. He says the problem isn't only about wages, it's that these workplaces are segregated from the general population.
They're being kept away from the rest of society. It doesn't help our perceptions of disability.
A few bills have tried to eliminate the subminimum wage, but never successfully. And this current round of minimum wage conversations doesn't seem like it'll end it either. In order to change things, Luna says we have to think about work differently.
We have to not think about a job description and trying to fit the disabled person into that job description, but looking at reasonable accommodations.
Grice, for example, was put in a job that didn't match his skills. It emphasized manual labor, but he's in a wheelchair and lacks hand dexterity. One day, about 5 months into his job, he looked down at his work, frustrated with how slow it was moving.
I just said to myself, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this.
Grice asked his social worker to take him out of the program and help him find a job in marketing or outreach like he had before at the gym.
Our response was, we're doing the best we can do. Just go along for now and we'll try our best.
Grice says many people at workshops are afraid to speak up or leave. Keep in mind these organizations sometimes also provide housing, transportation, and other services. But Grice knew that his situation was no longer working for him, so he left it all behind. He now lives in a nursing home and is looking for a job.
That was Shannon Heffernan of Illinois Public Radio reporting from Chicago. You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine on WILL. Well, recently, Apple's benevolence has been brought into question. Lawyers for the company will be back in court Tuesday defending them against government charges that they conspired with publishers to fix ebook prices. This, of course, right after accusations that Apple had been dodging taxes by setting up a shell company in Ireland. All of the major publishing houses settled months ago with the Justice Department. In the opening statements, Apple's lawyers said the company wouldn't settle because it didn't think it had done anything wrong. NPR's Laura Seidel has this report.
In his opening statement, a very poised Mark Ryan, the Justice Department attorney, brought in job statements and emails before and after the opening of the iBookstore. After the store opened, a reporter asked Jobs why prices for Apple books were higher than prices on Amazon. Jobs said, eventually, all the prices will be the same. Ryan said that proves Jobs knew Apple's deal would be used to put pressure on ebook giant Amazon to raise its prices. The government pointed out that ebooks from Apple could sell for as much as $14.99, well above Amazon's standard price at the time of $9.99. Apple points out that since it got into the market, overall ebook prices have actually come down. But New York Law School professor James Grimmelman says that doesn't really matter.
The conspiracy itself is illegal, whether or not it's successful in extracting money from consumers' pockets.
Apple's attorney, Oren Snyder, vigorously accused the government of twisting Jobs' email statements to make it, quote, fit into their conspiracy theory. Though publishing executives will take the stand during the trial, they've all settled with the Justice Department. Grimmelman believes Apple continues to fight because the retail model it's set up for ebooks is pretty much the same way it sells everything.
This is how they sell apps. It's how they sell music. For Apple, this goes to the heart of a very large business.
Grimmelman believes Apple worries that if it loses this case, it could have the Justice Department on its back for a while. The next few weeks, we'll see a parade of high-level executives take the stand, among them Eddie Q, who negotiated the deals with the record labels that turned Apple into a music retail giant. Now he's facing scrutiny for pushing a little too hard to get all the big publishers to sign up with Apple. Laura Seidel, NPR News, New York.
Well, Jell-O launched an ad campaign last week called Fun My Life, which piggybacks off the incredibly profane Twitter hashtag, #FML. You can probably figure it out if you've never heard that phrase before. Advertising consultants are divided on whether this campaign is brilliant or it crosses the line and hurts Jell-O's reputation as wholesome fun. NPR's Travis Larchuk has this report.
Jell-O's classic commercials end on these five letters. But on Twitter, the company's pared it down to just three letters, FML. According to Jell-O's new Twitter campaign, that stands for Fun My Life. But on the internet, F My Life is already a popular expression, except the F usually stands for a different, more profane word. For instance, someone might tweet, 3 flat tires in 6 months, FML. Not really language many people would associate with products once represented by family-friendly comedian Bill Cosby. Todd Yermstead is Jell-O's senior brand manager.
It's a really fun brand. And so, you know, FML being in the public lexicon as sometimes that maybe aren't so fun, we took those as a chance for us to use the fun of Jell-O to turn things around for folks.
On Twitter, reactions to the campaign ranged from delighted to disgusted. Helene Spivak is managing director of Brand Center, the advertising school at Virginia Commonwealth University, and she used to work on Jell-O's advertising near the end of the Cosby era.
Oh my God, I wouldn't even think that word in my head when I was working on Jell-O.
But she says she admires the company for taking a risk.
I could love it or I could hate it, but as soon as it's successful, I'm going to say it was absolutely brilliant.
Jell-O says the campaign will continue through mid-June. Travis Larchuk, NPR News.
WILO programming is made possible by Kranert Center for the Performing Arts, announcing the 2013-2014 season featuring El Nora, the Guitar Festival, Hungarian State Folk Ensemble Gypsy Romance, Meredith Monk on Behalf of Nature, the Moscow Festival Ballet, and more. Tickets are on sale Saturday, August 10th at 10 a.m.
In Afghanistan, when U.S. troops pull out, Afghan forces must take over.
I've been on dozens of patrols throughout the country with the U.S. forces and the Afghans. This is the first time I've actually seen them in the lead.
NPR's Tom Bowman on whether Afghan troops can hold on after the Americans leave. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, June 4th, 2013. On this date in 1896, a young electrical engineer named Henry Ford completed and successfully tested his first experimental automobile. He called it the quadricycle because it rolled around on four bicycle tires. He worked on it for 2 years out in the shed behind his house in Detroit. It was finally ready to test when he hit an unexpected snag. It was too wide to fit through the workshop doors. Ford took an axe to the doorframe and soon was rolling down Grand River Avenue. The quadricycle had a 2-cylinder, 4-horsepower engine and could achieve speeds of up to 20 miles per hour. It had 2 gears, no brakes, ran on pure ethanol, and was steered by means of a tiller, like a boat. It wasn't much to look at, just a 500-pound skeleton with a steel frame and no body, but the first test drive was a huge success. On this day in 1940, Carson McCullough's novel, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, first appeared. She was only 23, and the only thing she had published before was a short story. The novel, about a group of outcasts all drawn to the same deaf man, was a huge success. On this date in 1919, the 19th Amendment passed the Senate. 15 months later, it was ratified by the necessary 36 state legislatures, giving American women the right to vote. Susan B. Anthony drafted the original amendment with the help of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and it was first formally introduced in 1878. It sat in committee for 9 years before it went before the Senate in 1887 and was voted down. But in 1918, Woodrow Wilson threw his support behind the suffrage movement. Women had entered the workforce in large numbers during World War I, and in a speech that President Wilson gave in September, he said, "We have made partners of the women in this war. Shall we admit them only to a partnership of suffering and sacrifice and toil and not to a partnership of right?" The amendment passed both houses of Congress the following May. It was on this day in 1989 that the Chinese government cracked down on students who were conducting pro-democracy demonstrations in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. The demonstrations had begun months earlier, after the government accused the students of planning a coup d'etat. They drew thousands of supporters from 36 universities and staged hunger strikes and sit-ins. The government declared martial law, and in the late evening of June 3rd, troops approached the square with tanks. Soldiers surrounded the perimeter of the square, and the students expected that they would kill everyone at the center. Around 4 a.m., All the lights went out, and it got quiet. The students debated whether or not they should surrender. They heard the engines of the tanks start up, and finally they made the decision to evacuate. Almost all the students survived. And here's a poem by Tom Clark entitled, "The Day Goes On Forever." We're alone, my shadow and me. You're alone with your shadow, too. The first day and the last day the same. First song, same as last song. The stream weeps passing under concrete. Habitual deer have retreated. The earth is covered with vehicles meant to secure the unknown against us. The caged bird said, "This place is very pretty, excellent for lunch, fine for sleeping. But if I might ask one thing more, how come nobody thought to put in a door?" A poem by Tom Clark entitled "The Day Goes On Forever" from his collection Light and Shade, published